heaven, as conventionally conceived, is a place so inane, so dull, so useless, so miserable, that nobody has ever ventured to describe a whole day there, though plenty of people have described a day at the seaside. That's George Bernard Shaw in the preface to one of his plays, expressing a sentiment with which I do confess to have some sympathy. Heaven, I fear, in most people's minds, is not a particularly inviting place. Indeed, as a child, I can distinctly remember being deeply apprehensive at the prospect of going there one day myself. "What do you do there?" I asked my mother. "It'll be so boring." Partly the trouble was, I think, that my infantile image of heaven was largely shaped by the Gothic architecture of the local parish church, a place associated in my mind with interminable dreariness and hard pews on which one wasn't permitted to fidget, as I recall. However, as I reflect a bit more deeply, a little less superficially, I think I realise that my reservations about heaven actually go rather deeper than that. It wasn't simply the austerities of St. Michael's and All Angels on the corner of the High Street that were to blame. I had, in addition to that, a distinct uneasiness, I think, as a child, with the whole concept of eternity, generally. See, whenever I asked people what eternity was, they always told you, "It means living forever and ever, dear." Well, frankly, I found such an idea quite appalling. It was hard enough to keep myself amused during the 6 weeks of the school summer holiday. To have to do so for years and years and years on end, that was no recipe for perpetual bliss, but rather perpetual tedium. Indeed, if heaven really was anything like St. Michael's and All Angels, there wouldn't even be any toys to play with up there. Just the monotonous droning of the organ, not to mention the vicar. No, George Bernard Shaw was quite right. Give me a day at the seaside any time in preference to heaven. I sometimes wonder, you know, if underneath the intellectual objections that many sceptics raise to the Christian faith these days, there doesn't lie a very similar disquiet to that, albeit subconsciously. Certainly as I talk to many young people outside the church these days, I often come away feeling that they have rejected Christianity not because they are strongly convinced that it's false, but simply because the distinct impression has been given to them that it's dull, that the seaside would be better than heaven. It's a pity. It's a very great pity. Because as I realise now, it's all founded on a tragic misconception. The idea of living forever and ever is not only a very inadequate description of heaven, it's also a positively sub-Christian one. Spiritualists may be satisfied with simply surviving beyond the grave, but Christians aren't. Even the ancient Greeks perceived that mere immortality would not be a blessing for the human race, but a curse. But then Jesus never offered mere immortality. Didn't you notice what he said in verse 10 of our reading? "I have come that they may have life and have it to the full." Heaven then for Jesus was not an extension in the duration of life. Heaven for Jesus was an intensification of the experience of life. Jesus didn't come merely to offer us more life quantitatively. He came to offer us more life qualitatively. Life to the full. I don't know much about heaven, nobody does. But I guarantee you one thing about it, nobody there is ever bored. I doubt whether anybody in heaven ever thinks so much as to look at their watch. And haven't you sometimes had, just for perhaps a fleeting moment or two, such an experience of not wishing to look at your watch? Haven't you ever, some of you students, sat up late talking about things with your college friends? Talking and talking. The hours fly by, but you're never conscious of their passing, because there's a kind of glow inside you at the companionship you're experiencing. You don't want the evening to end. Well, that's what heaven is like. It's life to the full. sure perhaps some of you have felt that thrill, that very sublime rapture when you're reading a great book, or watching a great play, or listening to great music, as if joy had so totally enthralled you that it lifted you for that moment out of time and space altogether. Have you ever felt that? That's what heaven is like. It's life to the full. Or maybe you've climbed a mountain in the early morning and you've stood there on the summit, captivated by the grandeur of the scene, and felt that you could stand there forever and never grow tired of looking at it. Or maybe you've fallen in love and you know that very peculiar euphoria at the prospect of seeing him or seeing her once again. "I was just existing till I met you," we say. Well, that's what heaven is like. Life to the full. Forget about the Gothic architecture. Forget about the hard pews. Take the deepest enchantment you've ever known. Take the loftiest ecstasy you've ever felt. Take the greatest fulfillment you've ever experienced. Take that, even if it's only an instant, when you felt most totally alive, and intensify that instant a millionfold. And then perhaps you'll be getting in range of imagining what heaven is like. Jesus did not come to give us more time to kill. He came to give us more life to live. That's what he says. "I have come that they may have life and have it to the full." Now, I can imagine some of you here telling me that you find that difficult to believe. And I respect your incredulity, though I'd like to have the opportunity to change it. But if any one of you says he finds that too dull to interest him, or too unattractive to be worth investigating, well, frankly, I am at a loss to imagine what you would consider exciting or important. Jesus has come to offer us life, he says. Life to the full. And I want us in our study this morning to discover three vital things about that life if we're going to enjoy it as Jesus wants us to. They come out of this parable, a parable of pastoral life, which Jesus first tells us in verses 1 to 6 of John 10, and then progressively interprets to us. And it's the interpretation I want us particularly to focus on. First of all, I want us to look at the source of this fullness of life. In verses 7 to 10, where Jesus is interpreting what he calls the sheep gate. And then I want us to look at the cost of this fullness of life, which he talks about in verses 11 to 18, and which center around his interpretation of the shepherd motif. And then finally, I want us to look at the gift of this fullness of life, as he speaks about it in verses 25 to 30, telling us a bit more about the sheep themselves. Let's start then with the source of this life and the figure of the gate. "I tell you the truth," Jesus says in verse 1, "the man who does not enter the sheep pen by the gate, but climbs in by some other way, is a thief and a robber." Now, they didn't have bank vaults in Jesus' day. Their wealth was measured in cattle, not coloured pieces of paper, or sheep, herds and flocks. But security against theft, of course, was still very important in those days. And so every town or village had the equivalent of a bank, and that was a sheep pen, an enclosed space where the animals could be looked after, with high walls and a gate, and beside the gate, or perhaps even lying down in its entrance, a guard. Now, of course, bona fide shepherds would recognize the watchman and be recognized by him, and they would be allowed through the gate to summon their flock, and they would do that just by calling some name, some bidding. On the other hand, anybody who tried to climb over the wall to get in, they were obviously up to no good. They were out to steal the sheep, or to slaughter them. As Jesus puts it, they were thieves and robbers. The distinction between a thief and a robber there is that the second word Jesus uses has an additional connotation of violence, as well as larceny. So everybody you see in Jesus' audience in those days knew exactly what he meant when he said the only legitimate way into a sheep pen is through the gate. Well, says Jesus, "I am the gate for the sheep." Verse 7. I am the gate. All who ever came before me were thieves and robbers, but the sheep did not listen to them. I am the gate. Whoever enters through me will be saved. It's another one of these startling and in the Greek language very emphatic statements, which we've grown accustomed to in these discourses in John's Gospel, which put all the emphasis on the first person singular pronoun. I am the gate. Jesus then is distinguishing himself here very forcibly from certain others whom he derogates not just as his rivals, but as criminals, thieves and robbers. And to understand what he's talking about, we first then have to identify who these others are. Now, there are basically two possibilities. The first possibility is that Jesus is referring here, by thieves and robbers, to the Jewish establishment of his own day. If you look back at the previous chapter, you'll see that this discourse in chapter 10 flows straight on from that controversy which Jesus began to have with the high-ranking Jews back in chapter 8, and which we had started to look at last week. In fact, at the very end of chapter 9, we find Jesus contradicting the Pharisees in a very outspoken way, telling them that they're not really competent to lead others because they're spiritually blind. And he says, your refusal to admit the fact you're blind renders you all the more culpably so. So it's tempting to identify the thieves and robbers that Jesus goes on to describe immediately in chapter 10, verse 1, as these Pharisees and others like them. As if Jesus were saying, they aren't the true shepherds of God's flock, though they may claim to be, though they may pretend to be. They are in fact just vandals who cause irreparable damage to God's sheep. And there are many commentators who pursue that line of interpretation through these verses. But I have to tell you that there is a serious flaw, to my mind, in that line of interpretation. And that's the phrase in verse 8 that we read. All who ever came before me were thieves and robbers. Now that seems a very unnatural way to speak of the Jewish establishment to me. Firstly, because they were not Jesus' predecessors, they were his contemporaries. So why does he talk about them coming before him? And secondly, because of the comprehensiveness of the phrase, all who ever came before me, he says. But Jesus, what about Nicodemus and the others who we read of among the Jewish aristocracy who were putting their faith in you, contrary to the general trend among their peers? You can't offer a blanket condemnation of every priest and scribe who's ever exerted influence on the Jewish people, surely, Jesus. Now, the only way I think we can make sense of what Jesus says in that phrase, verse 8, is to say that, in fact, it wasn't a Jewish establishment that's in his mind at all here by these thieves and robbers. It's something else. It is, in fact, the false messiahs who had arisen in Israel and with whom he was constantly in danger of being confused by the people at large. We know from other first century historical sources that there were many of these charismatic leaders in the century or so immediately preceding Jesus' ministry. Indeed, Galilee, his own home area, was notorious as a seedbed for their movements. And those of you who've been following this series of studies through John perhaps won't be totally surprised to find an allusion to them here in this chapter, because John seems to have a very special concern to demonstrate to his readership that there is a radical distinction between these political activists who were so common and so well known to the people of his day and Jesus. In fact, we've noticed several references to that already, not the least being that one back in chapter 6, remember, when Jesus rejected the invitation of that Galilean mob to be their king. Well, it seems to me that this is one more of those verses where we see an example of the evangelist's interest in showing us that Jesus was not a political messiah. The imagery of thieves and robbers, of course, was much more obviously applicable to these self-styled saviors of Israel than it was to the Jewish establishment, for without exception they were men of violence, quite literally, seeking to free Israel from the yoke of imperial Rome by revolution. Some of us would call them freedom fighters. Others would call them terrorists. As in all these things, it depends on your point of view. But whatever verdict you pass on their activities, the important thing as far as Jesus was concerned is this, that they exploited the messianic expectations of the people. Once we've thrown out the Romans, they said, then the new age of peace and plenty that the prophets talk about in the Old Testament, it will arrive, it will dawn. Some of them, in fact, made quite personal claims to be the Messiah. They didn't say they were just shepherds in the general sense, that is, national leaders. They arrogated to themselves the title the shepherd, that is, the Messiah, of whom Ezekiel had spoken in the Old Testament when he said, I will save my flock, Israel, and I will place over them one shepherd, my servant David. He will tend them and be their shepherd. So you see, when Jesus says, all who ever came before me are thieves and robbers, he's saying very emphatically that all those, without exception, who had claimed such messianic titles in the past had been imposters. Their violent methods were themselves evidence of their imposture, he says. I am the gate. I'm the only one who has the right to be called the Christ, the Messiah. The way to the promised kingdom of heaven is through me and through absolutely nobody else. That's what he's saying. Now, you see, if we're right in detecting this allusion to the revolutionary movements of the first century in these verses, if you think about it, that means that this passage has a very direct and important relevance to our 20th century situation. For, of course, the only real hope for the future which modern man can embrace in his disaffection with the traditional Christian idea of heaven, the only alternative to that is some kind of humanistic utopia. And the classic expression of that humanistic utopia, of course, derives from the genius of Karl Marx. His classless society, as he put it. In many respects, it's just a secularized version of heaven. Marx said that people can only discover their true happiness, their true fulfillment, their true life, once they have liberated themselves from oppression and exploitation, and discovered in the collapse of the capitalist system the bliss of participating in a paradise on earth, where all the old alienations have been dissolved and where man is free to discover his full human potential. That's the Marxist dream. And it's a very powerful thought. Well, there clearly are grave weaknesses in the capitalist system, and it's very tempting for us to blame all our frustrations and misery in life upon its victimization of us. And yet, you see, in a very real sense, that was precisely what these false messiahs in Jesus' day were saying in their own way. It's imperialism, they said, that's the problem. If we can only overthrow the Romans, then the kingdom of God will arrive. Well, I want you to notice very clearly the response Jesus makes to that. It's an emphatic no. Don't be duped by these messiahs of violence, he says. They are not saviors at all. They are brigands. Thieves and robbers, see the hallmarks of their stock in trade. A blatant disregard for personal property. They come to steal, he says. A ruthless indifference to human life. They come to kill, he says. An irrational contempt for anything of value. They come to destroy, he says. That's what they stand for. And frankly, 2,000 years have not changed the pattern. This trio of criminality has been characteristic of every revolutionary movement the world has seen, not least the Marxist variety with which our 20th century is so plagued. I know we often cite the appalling genocides of Hitler against the Jews as a kind of symbol of the degree in which man's inhumanity to man can go. And yet, you know, the cold statistical truth is that compared to the vast millions who have perished under Lenin, under Stalin, under Mayer in our century, the death toll of fascist Germany seems almost modest. That's the appalling truth. And what has been achieved by all this hideous carnage, this revolutionary violence? Where is this perfect society of which Marx dreamt? Do we find it in Russia? Do we find it in China? Now, Jesus is right. It isn't the Christian doctrine of heaven that is the myth. It's the humanist dream of utopia that is mythical. That's the thing that never comes. Now, of course, revolutionaries do accomplish something sometimes. Jesus is not such a fool as to forget that the life of his nation had occasionally benefited from a coup d'etat. But he would have us realize two very important things here. Firstly, that whatever revolutions achieve, they do so only at the expense of much property, many lives, and incalculable destruction of culture. The thief comes to steal and kill and destroy. And secondly, and more importantly, whatever these revolutions achieve, they never bring to man that new quality of fulfillment in life that their ideological messiahs promised. I am the gate, says Jesus. I and nobody else. I've come that they might have life. People who come my way, he says, they are the ones who find true liberty. They go in and they go out. They're the ones who find true deliverance. They are saved. They're the ones who find true fulfillment. They find pasture. A man must enter by me then if he wants to find real liberation, real satisfaction, real life. I am the gate. And note very carefully. I don't carry a machine gun. I carry a cross. And that brings us to the second element in this parable I want us to think about. The source of life, the cost of life. Look at verse 11. I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. Now it's important to realize when you read that phrase, the good shepherd, that for a Jew, it would not generate the kind of sentimentality which I suspect it does in us. For some reason, in English culture, shepherds are viewed as rather romantic figures who spend most of their time cuddling little lambs and roaming hillsides with their faithful dogs. Well, that wasn't the image a shepherd had in Israel. They were men who lived dangerous lives. But more important than that, when shepherd was used with the definite article, the shepherd, by somebody like Jesus, as we've already seen, it had a messianic significance. It evoked feelings not so much of sentimentality, but of royalty. And that's why Jesus' audience is thrown into such a state of bewilderment. If he'd said, I am the shepherd come to lead Israel to freedom, there's not one of them that would miss what he was going on about. But Jesus didn't. Instead, he insisted on welding this messianic metaphor of the shepherd with the thought of death. Jesus' messiahship was not going to be like that of these impostors who'd come before him. Their messiahship had taken the lives of men. Jesus' messiahship was going to give life to men, but only at the expense of his own. I want you to notice three things about Jesus' death, which he emphasizes very clearly here as he anticipates it. The first thing you'll notice is that Jesus is quite convinced that his death is going to be a loving death. The hired hand is not the shepherd who owns the sheep, he says. So when he sees the wolf coming, he abandons the sheep and runs away. Then the wolf attacks the flock and scatters it. Why does he run away? Because he's a hired hand and he cares nothing for the sheep. That says Jesus, I'm the good shepherd. I lay down my life for the... Of course, the word good can mean various things for us, can't it? We can talk about a good car, if it works. We can talk about a good man, if he's morally upright. The interesting thing about that phrase, that word good, which John uses there, is that the word he actually chooses is not the normal word that you might associate either with efficiency or moral uprightness. It's a word that has a distinct overtone of attractiveness. It means good to look at. It means beautiful in the narrowest sense. So John is sort of saying here, look, people are won to Jesus. Not by the efficiency of his party machine. Not because they embrace his political ambitions. It's the magnetism of Jesus' personal goodness that draws them to him. A goodness which they are persuaded really cares for them intimately, and which is nowhere better seen than in his willingness to die on their behalf. Of course, there are those who appear to be shepherds, but are actually just hired men. They're professionals. They're in it for what they get out of it. They're motivated by self-interest. And as a result, when you really need those people, you can't rely on them because they aren't really interested in you. They're just professional do-gooders. We've all met that kind of person. But Jesus isn't like that. He's really concerned about us. He really wants us to enjoy fulfillment in life. And he's proved it. If we had any doubt about it, he's proven it by dying for us. It was a loving death. Nowhere do we see the love in Christ's heart more clearly than there, on that cross. But the second thing I want you to notice that comes out of this passage regarding Jesus' death, it was also a planned death. Look at verse 18. No one takes my life from me, he says. I lay it down of my own accord. I've got authority to lay it down and authority to take it up again. William Barclay tells the story of a young man in the First World War who was wounded in the trenches during an attack. And the medic who came to treat him had to say to him, "I'm sorry, soldier, you've lost your arm." And the young soldier is reputed to have replied, "Doc, I didn't lose it. I gave it." Jesus is saying something rather similar here, but even stronger. Because he's not just saying, you see, that he came into this world willing to die, if necessary, like a soldier going into battle. He's saying he came into this world knowing that death would be necessary, knowing that he would have to give his life. It was planned. And right through his life, that plan never faltered. He was in control, he says. He was in control of his destiny all the time. He didn't see himself as a tragic victim of circumstances. Such was his personal authority over events. No one could take Jesus' life from him against his will, he claims. His death was a voluntary act of sacrifice. The most voluntary act of sacrifice any man has ever been capable of. No man takes it from me, he says. I lay it down. It was a planned death, and it had, you notice, a specific goal. I know my sheep. And my sheep know me, he says in verse 14. And I lay down my life for those sheep. Now that's a very remarkable statement. Jesus is saying that as he looked out on the world, his eyes were able to penetrate through time and space, in a sense, and all through the world, he was conscious that there were people who in some very intimate way belonged to him. My sheep. In some very distinctive way, they were his. I know them, he says. I'm not ignorant of them. They're not just a faceless multitude. They are personally known to me. In fact, he says, there are other sheep outside this sheep pen. I've got to bring them also. He's thinking there almost certainly of going outside Israel to the Gentile nations, to the nations to the four corners of the world. He says, I've got my sheep there too. There are people who belong to me, he said, throughout this world. And he said, it's for them that I'm dying. For my sheep. I know we sometimes say Jesus died for the world. John says it. And in a very real sense, that's correct. There's no limit to Jesus' death. But at the same time, it's perfectly true to say that Jesus was not dying for a generalized mass of humanity. He tells us here he knew whom he was dying for. He had them in his mind. Perhaps sometimes he even had their faces in his mind. They're my sheep, he says. I'm dying for them. And there's no doubt in his voice that that planned death of his would be successful. I will bring them, he says. They will listen to my voice. There shall be one flock and one shepherd. There's no doubt. There's a confidence there. Now, this planned death would achieve what it set out to achieve. But that brings us to the third thing we have to notice if we're going to make sense of what Jesus is saying here. It was a loving death. It was a planned death. But thirdly, it was a saving death. Twice he says it in verse 11, and then again in verse 15. It was for the sheep. Now, what do you make of that? Some people say it means that Jesus died to set the sheep an example, to set them an example of unselfishness. Well, of course, a shepherd's death certainly does prove that he's a very unselfish person. As distinct from the hired hand, he has a personal interest and care for the sheep. He wouldn't have died otherwise. But what sense does it make to say the shepherd dies in order to set the sheep an example? I mean, suppose you were a sheep out in the wilderness somewhere, and your shepherd said to you, I love you, sheep, and I'm going to jump over this cliff to prove it. Do you make any sense of that? No. Even if sheep were more intelligent than they're supposed to be, they wouldn't make sense of that. Only in circumstances where the sheep were in danger would the death of the shepherd make sense as an act of love. Isn't that true? That's the only possible situation that could arise where a shepherd would die for his sheep as an intelligible act of devotion to them. In fact, Dr. Thompson, in his travelogue of the Middle East, actually recounts such an occasion when a Semitic shepherd defended his flock against three Bedouin robbers and was cut to pieces in the act. That makes sense to us as a demonstration of love and of dedication to his sheep. Jumping off a cliff wouldn't. And that's why, you see, Jesus has to mention the wolf. In verse 12, when he sees the wolf coming, he abandons the sheep and runs away. A reason many people have difficulty understanding why Jesus had to die for them is because they don't realize what danger they are in. It's as simple as that. There's a wolf coming. Jesus knew it. Sinful men and women like us, one day we're going to die. And after we die, we're going to face God in judgment. Jesus knew that was our situation. It was an immensely perilous one. That's why we live in such misery and emptiness all life long. Because the wolf is coming. Haven't you ever seen a sheep flock when there's a predator near, a dog even? They rush around in panic. Completely futile. And that's our human condition. We know we are doomed to die. And that knowledge mocks us. It starts mocking us from the very moment in our young years when we realize we're going to die one day, and it continues mocking us through middle age, and it goes on mocking us right up until the end. The wolf is coming. It's appointed to men to die, and after death, the judgment. That's why we need a shepherd. A good shepherd, not a hired hand, not a professional do-gooder. We need the kind of shepherd who is willing to take our death from our shoulders and bear it himself. That's the kind of love we need to be the recipients of. That's the kind of plan we need to have enacted on our behalf. And that's what Jesus means when he says he's the good shepherd and gives his life for the sheep. He didn't give it to us just to prove how much he loved us. He gave his life to save us from the wolf. He gives us life only by taking death upon himself. And that brings us to the third thing I want you to think about this morning. The gift of life itself. Look at verses 27 to 28. You don't believe, he says to the Jews, because you're not my sheep. My sheep listen to my voice. I know them, and they follow me, and I give them eternal life. Jesus is doing here what we've seen him do so often in John's Gospel. He's separating human beings into two groups. On the one hand, he says, there are some people who don't understand the cross. They don't understand Jesus. They don't realize how much danger they're in. They don't realize how close to disaster they are. They feel safe, they feel happy, they feel secure. They sense no wolf prowling around, and so they feel no need of a shepherd to protect them. I can do without Jesus, they say. We don't need you, Jesus. In a word, they don't believe in him. Because they're not his sheep, says Jesus. But, says Jesus, there's another group. And they feel totally differently about things. They know their lives are empty and spoiled, and they desperately want to find that life in all its fullness that Jesus claims to provide. Is that the number you belong to? Jesus here gives us some very clear tests, some very obvious marks by which to know whether we are of that company. My sheep listen to my voice. Oh, they've heard other voices clamoring for their attention. The revolutionaries, the philosophers. All kinds of people have been saying, come my way, I'm the way. But some kind of gut intuition in them has told them that all those claims are false. That all those other philosophies and other ideas, they're not really going to meet that deep need in their heart. Oh, they might dabble in it for a little while, but they quickly grow disillusioned. Eventually they run away from those strange voices because they can hear another voice beckoning to them. They hear it through the pages of this book. And somehow that voice compels their attention. They recognize it as the voice of the one who can meet their need. Have you felt that? But more than that, says Jesus, they don't only listen to my voice, they follow me, he says. They follow me. I like the way Jesus puts it, they follow me. Because some people, you know, have the idea that when you become a Christian, Jesus wants to sort of shut you in, to make you in a kind of cage, to limit all your freedom, to be a spoil sport, to take away all your fun. It all goes back to what we were saying earlier about Christianity being dull. But that isn't the pattern as Jesus sees it. His sheep follow him, he says. They follow freely. They're not coerced. They're not whipped. They're not driven as though by a butcher. They follow voluntarily because they know that's where their true freedom, where their true fulfillment lies. Or there may be some stupid sheep that prefer life in the sheep pen, or with one of those thieves and robbers, or even the hired hands. Thus says Jesus, my sheep know where they're well off. They follow me. And it's in following me that they discover that life that I've been talking about. And that brings us to the third thing that marks out these sheep. They hear the voice of Jesus and recognize it for the authoritative voice it is. They follow Jesus. They change their lives in order to be obedient to him, to make him the captain of their lives. And he says, thirdly, they enjoy the security of the shepherd. I give them eternal life, and they shall never perish. No one can snatch them out of my hand. Isn't it true that all around this world today there are people who are feeling insecure? They're not necessarily people who are neurotic and bowed down by their inadequate upbringings. They may be quite sane, well-balanced people, but they still feel insecure because they don't know where they're going. They don't know what they're here for. They don't really feel they belong. They don't really feel anybody loves them. They are cynical about life, about relationships, about careers, about just about everything. And at the root of that cynicism is insecurity. They have got nowhere to stand. Am I not saying the truth when I say what they need to feel is the security of the shepherd's hand? I give them eternal life, says Jesus. This new life, this life abundant, it's a free gift to my sheep, and they'll never perish. And no one can ever remove them from the security of that new relationship they have with me. It's impossible. My Father himself, who has given them to me, he's greater than anything. His hand is invincible. And I and the Father are one. It's a story told which I love about John Brown, the great Scottish pastor, who was visiting a lady on her deathbed once. Jane, he said, what would you say if after all that God has done for you, God should let you perish? She thought for a moment, and then the old woman said, well, if he does, he'd lose more than I would, I reckon. For I'd only lose my soul. He'd lose his honour. He has said they shall never perish. Dare I ask you whether you've heard the voice of the shepherd? Dare I ask you whether, having heard it, you followed him? That's what Jesus is calling us to, isn't it? A life of discipleship. A life in that group who respond to his call. I can't tell you where that life may lead you. It would be irresponsible of me to tell you it was all going to be a bed of roses. But perhaps if you became a Christian today, all the problems you're conscious of when you walked into this church would evaporate on the way out. Not going to be like that. Indeed, I don't even know what sort of future God has planned for you. For conversion is crossing a Rubicon. You can be in for anything. But one thing I do promise you, you won't find life with Jesus boring, even though it does last forever. Let's pray together.